Welcome to the Traveling Senorita, episode number 41. As I have said, through the COVID ISO lockdown, I still managed to find the stories that I love around the world. We headed to Philadelphia last week. We're in Spain the week before, back to the Northern Rivers. And now I have found myself somewhere I've wanted to go for a long time. In fact, I do go here myself on a personal level, but I wanted to find out the story behind the renowned Stone and Wood beer. So today I've managed to corner one of the co-owners, Ross Jevicic, and he's joining me today to tell me about his journey on how he started out in life and how he ended where he is now. Not that your life's over, Ross. Welcome, Ross.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Carl. It's good to see you.
You too, buddy. So beer, love beer. We will end there, but I'm sure this conversation is going to be threaded the whole time with some relationship back to where you are now. So where did you grow up? First and foremost, where's your name from?
Jurisic, it's a Montenegrin name, and I'm a result of the Great Australian Melting Pot.
Yep.
So classic Anglo-Saxon parents on my mother's side, first settlement, and then Montenegrin immigrants on my dad's side.
So. Oh, as you do. So where did they meet, mum and dad?
In Melbourne. So my mum was an air hostess and my father was growing tobacco in northeastern Victoria.
And as you do.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah, probably another vice. Tobacco, beer probably go together.
Yeah.
They met at a party in Melbourne and
So did you spend your junior years growing up on a tobacco farm in Victoria?
Yeah, I did spend a few years growing up on a tobacco farm. It wasn't long before my mum was originally from Sydney. It wasn't long before she wanted to head back to Sydney. So we spent some time back in Sydney. My father did odd things, odds and jobs and what have you. Funnily enough, got into the futures trading market.
Yep.
And then we ended up back on the farm when things didn't go so well. And then into southeast Queensland, so onto the Gold Coast, and I spent all of my high school years on the Gold Coast.
So did Dad have a farming background from his parents?
Yeah, so his parents immigrated from Montenegro during the Second World War. They had a banana plantation in Carnarvon, so halfway up the West Australian coast. They used to get wiped out by a cyclone every year or every second year, and the Victorian government was giving land away in northeastern Victoria if you farmed it. So they travelled from Western Australia to Victoria, were given a piece of land at the foothills of Mount Buffalo.
Beautiful
area. It's gorgeous. And started growing tobacco, which was the crop that was grown in and around that area at the time.
From their heritage in Montenegro, was the tobacco farming?
No.
Something they came up with in Australia?
Yeah, no, they when they immigrated, they were cutting timber in southern Western Australia, and then farming in the north. To be quite honest, I'm not sure if they did a whole lot of farming in Montenegro. I guess back then they did.
Have you been there?
No, haven't quite been there. I'd like to get there.
Yeah, I feel like it's on your journey.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, isn't it, when you talk about we're in this COVID isolation time now. Fast forward, we've gone so forward in digital, but in a way we're going back to sustainable farming. So when you mentioned the government giving away parcels of land for farming, I think automatically of the Northern Rivers, because and you guys have got the distillery over in Moolumbah, the sugarcane industry. That's how it started there. They were giving away parcels of farming land. So just off the top of my head, do you think that is something that may come back one day? I feel like it could.
Yeah, possibly. When they were giving parcels of land, particularly in the Northern Rivers, one of the provisos was that you had to clear 100% of the land.
Right.
And having a chat to the Brook family, who the guys who've got Brookies Gin and what have you, they have quite a good sense of the history in these parts. And Big Scrub, which was the largest rainforested area in Australia, is here in the Northern Rivers.
Okay.
But there's only 1% of it left. And the reason for that is because
they
cleared it for farming.
So that's not sustainable.
I would suggest not. But who knows, maybe Crown land could be given up to sustainable farming.
Well, because, you know, the localisation is coming up a lot at the moment versus globalisation, importing of, you know, and I think we are very blessed to live where we are because we've had so much good produce delivered to our door through this isolation stage, and it's shone through with the Tweed, you know, produce through to Northern Rivers. Without me going off into that, because I do want to end there, because I know Stoner Wood's all about sustainability and I want to talk about that a lot towards the end of this podcast. But before I skip to there, where did you go to school on the Gold Coast?
To a school called TSS, or the Southport School. It's a boys' school on the Gold Coast. I briefly went to university. Mm-hmm. I was never much of an academic as it was anyway, so... Mm-hmm. I wasn't much good at schoolwork, but I was fortunate that the school that I went to had a very good business management program. Mm-hmm. So for years 11 and 12, we got to study 100% business subjects, which I really enjoyed. We also had entrance to tertiary university if we wanted to. Mm-hmm. I'd spent one semester at uni and decided that it wasn't for me, and then I went travelling after that, and which I would suggest is probably...
Where did you go?
Europe, the US, yeah. And I think that's a pretty good undergraduate degree, if you ask me.
I did the same. So when you came back, where did you live when you came back from your big time overseas?
Came back to the Gold Coast, started working in the hospitality industry, pubs and bars and what have you. And I love the industry. I love being around people. And then from that led to a role with Carlton United Breweries, working on what they call the other side of the fence, so being a supplier to that industry. So I spent nearly 11 years with Carlton United Breweries. I did an MBA during that time. So academics definitely wasn't my thing earlier on in life, but I had an appreciation for it later in life. And did an MBA while I was at Carlton United Breweries. I met Jamie Cook and Brad Rogers during my time there. Mm-hmm. We'll get into it a little bit later, I guess, but went on to form
partners,
Stoner Wood.
Partners of Stoner Wood. So were you doing, repping customer service, sort of, is that how you started in the CUB line of work?
Yeah, I was the sales rep for Carlton United Breweries in Toowoomba. So it was very hard at the time to get a role with an organisation like that, particularly with no sales experience.
Yes.
Anyway, long story short, I landed a job as a salesperson in Toowoomba, of all places. And I'd never actually been to Toowoomba before I went up there for the role.
You're a surfer, I imagine.
I don't like going too far west, funnily enough. And so I spent 2 years with Carlton United in Toowoomba. Then I came down for a role on the Gold Coast. I was there for a brief time before moving into the marketing area of Carlton United Breweries in...
head office.
Well, in Brisbane.
So CUB was coming out of Brisbane head office?
The head office for Carlton United Breweries is in Melbourne. But we had state offices, and so... We had an office in Brisbane with its own marketing team. It was fairly self-sufficient, actually, the states back then, New South Wales, every state. I spent a bit of time in marketing.
Like politics, mate.
Yeah, absolutely. All over the shop.
Let's not talk about that border scenario.
And then I was transferred to South Australia in a marketing role. Spent a year or so down there, and then came back to the Brisbane office to help rebuild Matilda Bay Brewing Company, which is a craft beer division of Carlton United Breweries that we were rebirthing.
So craft beer, hang on, you had a stint in WA as well, did you say?
Just growing up,
right,
not
okay.
working.
Well, you pretty much covered the country.
Yes, indeed.
Great. Sydney? We didn't talk about you.
Yeah, I was born in Sydney. Okay. Yeah, I spent time growing up there.
Okay, you've covered the country here. We're missing a couple of territories and a little island off somewhere there too. Beautiful Tasmania, I'm sure you've spent time there. So with the craft beer, because you and I were born around about the same time, and you know I grew up with the good old BB at the footy. So craft beer, when did that actually come about? Were you part of that vibe in Australia?
Yeah, in Australia, it was, you could argue that craft beer, you know, different flavoured beer in different formats has been around for a long time.
Yes.
But you could argue that Matilda Bay Brewing Company really set the scene for craft or independent beer in Australia. And that was a West Australian outfit. Great guys, very creative, very innovative. And my business partner, Jamie, he started with Matilda Bay Brewing Company after doing a stint overseas. He originally was with Castlemaine Perkins in Brisbane.
Mm-hmm.
And after coming back to Australia, he went to Western Australia, started with Matilda Bay Brewing Company.
So Matilda Bay was an independent brewer that CUB ended up
buying, yeah,
right,
back
okay.
in the early 90s.
Yeah, so let's describe for those that don't know, what is craft beer?
So craft beer is essentially non-mainstream, non-macro brewed beer. It's often small batch brewing. It's more flavoursome than mainstream beer.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to nail down exactly what craft beer is because there's a whole bunch of different descriptors for it, and each person has their own idea of what craft beer is. But we just normally describe it as flavoursome beer that's differentiated to.
And it's going off into so many, like you start back in Matilda Bay, look where craft beer is now. You know, like I've caught up with some guys in Tassie that have, they use the whey from the cheese to make beer, you know,
yes.
And I was like, oh, really? Wow. Like it just seems to keep going off into, I think even Husk were using some of yours to make the,
yes.
What were they doing? Scotch or something with beer.
Yeah.
Like it goes into so many different levels,
yeah,
doesn't
indeed.
It?
Yeah. You're only limited by your imagination when it comes to flavour and beer.
Yeah.
And there's so much opportunity to be original. Yeah, you can do whatever you like.
It's really funny because growing up on the Mornington Peninsula, we used to down the pots of VB and then go to the footy and drink warm beer and have really bad pies. And so I went off beer. I was like, mum, beered out, and went straight onto the wines. Having, you know, growing up on the Mornington Peninsula, we were lucky to have that. But then I went right off beer. But I've lately come back because you've got this gatherer beer that's brought someone like me back because I need a bit more of that kind of, I don't know, it's not a girly flavour. Just a bit more not beer. I think I was ruined by, you don't comment, I can, but the VB days for me were just, a little bit too fast and furious. So I had to go off them for a little while, and now I'm a lover of wine, but I do like your gatherer, which we'll talk about in a moment. So I've skipped a few here. We've gone over to Stone and Wood. Let's go back again to when you, what you learned from CUB. So how long were you there for?
Nearly 11 years.
Right, so you're in a huge, like almost like an apprenticeship of business at this stage. And then you yourself and Jamie.
And Brad.
You, Jamie and Brad, all worked at CUB.
Yes.
And decided to, how do we get to where we are now, Ross?
Yes, it's Stone and Wood. So Jamie and I probably work more closely together at Carlton United Brewers in the sales and marketing area of the business. Brad was in production, and Brad, very creative when it comes to producing different styles and flavours of beer. He's a Roseworthy graduate, so he's a winemaker by trade.
Mm.
Anyway, Jamie was given the job of rebirthing Matilda Bay Brewing Company. That was his gig, to develop a craft beer category within Carlton United Breweries, because CUB didn't have an answer to what Lion Nathan were doing with their malt shovel beers.
Right.
So their malt shovel beers are James Squires, etc. So this is back in the early 2000s.
Mm.
So Jamie was tasked with putting a group of people together to create a business within a business. And that was really the warm-up for us, for Stone & Wood Brewing Company. So we started this business of Matilda Bay Brewing Company, or rebirthing it, because Carlton United Brewers already had it, but it was defunct.
Mm.
And we learned a tremendous amount out of doing that, and took a lot of those learnings and applied them to doing our own thing, which was Stone & Wood Brewing Company. Because at the time, we were becoming more specialised and focused in what we're doing in a large organisation.
Yep.
And you run the risk of becoming redundant very quickly when you go down that path. And for us, it was about continuing to do something that we loved to do, which was producing and developing, marketing and selling beer, but doing it our own way, and ensuring our own livelihoods in the process.
With an independence about you, obviously. So those three skills are, sales, marketing and production. You've nailed it, right?
Yeah, so we were the only people in the 120-year history of CUB to have left the brewery and go and start our own. Wow. And the reason for that is you needed people who were willing to give up good paying jobs, yep. careers, to gamble everything that they had,
yep.
With complementing skill sets to come together and have a go.
So we're talking 12, so 15
it was
years
yeah
ago,
so it was April 2006 is when we decided to push the button and actually get on with doing it. We had spoken a lot about doing it before that, and we're sitting in De Graves Lane in Melbourne, and we said, are we going
to... Great place to sit.
Yeah, it's cracking spot.
Having a beer, yeah.
And we said, are we going to keep talking about this, or are we actually going to do it? And it was the 1st of April 2006, and we said, right, who's in? We're in. And that was the start of it. Then we spent the next 2 years planning for it. And on the 1st of April 2008, we took possession of a property in the industrial estate in Byron Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And we started fitting that out and receiving equipment, brewing gear, brew house, etc., etc.
And as you said, it's a gamble, isn't it? Like, I've pretty much been a freelancer and a self-starter all my life. I have worked in corporate before. And when you do make that leap, you are letting go of, you know, your superannuation and all your sureties. And you, I gather you borrowed money to invest into the company. You know, you're setting up a partnership with two mates as well. There's a lot of risk per se, but obviously the reward has paid off.
Yeah. I think people who go into this type of thing, and it doesn't matter if it's brewing or winemaking or whatever business that you're doing, there's a high level of naivety that allows you to actually do it, because the three of us were all naive to setting up a business from scratch. And I think if you knew everything that was going to be involved, you may second guess yourself and maybe not have a go. But once we committed to doing it, there was no turning back. We had gambled everything that we had on it. So failure wasn't really an option anyway.
Isn't it interesting you say that? I've never heard anyone describe it as naivety allows you to do it. So you and I, looking back in our ripe old ages, on you'd see a lot of young people now going out and starting businesses. If you could kind of give them advice, you would, but you can't really, because you can only learn it from doing it.
Yeah, you can only learn it from making, you know, mistakes and not understanding exactly what's going to be involved. But stumbling through that, you know, you become very resourceful and find solutions to problems that you didn't even know were going to arise. And so no is just an opportunity to find a solution to something, really.
Yeah, so how do... So it's like a marriage, right? So the three of you have been in business a long time now, work together, know each other really well. I'm sure you spend more time together than you spend probably with your families a lot of the time. What's the success to that partnership?
I think the success to our particular partnership is that we weren't mates. We were workmates.
Correct.
So
yeah.
We understood each other's work ethic, values, but all those things were aligned. We shared a love of this industry. And so when we launched into it, we knew what to expect. We had a very clear understanding of what each person brought to the partnership. We had a very clear expectation of what we were going to get from this business over a long period of time. Given that we know the industry very well, we knew it was going to be a 3-year grind until we could just break even. And we had a very detailed 5-year business plan. We probably got to our 5-year business plan within 4 years, but it still took us 3 years to break even. But we knew that that was going to happen. So, you know, when you're sitting there in year 1.5 and year 2.5 and you're still bleeding cash, it's okay, because we all know what we were in for, and we will see light at the end of the tunnel, and we've just got to grind it out till then.
So when did you start to realise the success of this business?
It definitely wasn't in the first 1 or 2 years, that's for sure. Approaching the end of year 3, when we could see some black numbers start to appear on the P&L, we knew that we were definitely on the right path. Years 4 and 5, we continued to grow out of that. It was probably years 4 to 5 that we knew that we really had something, and we just had to keep going at it, keep reinventing our business, looking for opportunities, but keeping a very close handle on the business basics. And we coined this term. It was soft shell, hard center. So at the core, or the hard center of everything that we did, was a cold hard production business. The soft shell was the warm and fuzzies of a great marketing beer business, but we've always been very, very disciplined on the business aspects of it.
That's really, I like that. That makes me understand your business even more. What does success look like to you?
Me personally, success looks like freedom.
Oh, what a great answer.
Yeah, and autonomy, you know, which is one of the reasons that we went into it. The freedom to be creative in your workplace, to come up with different styles and brands and what have you, to have artistic freedom is an amazing thing. To have the autonomy in your personal life to do things that you want to do. We often talk about work-life blend here at Stone & Wood. It's not work-life balance, because we think work-life balance is utopia and you'll never get there, and everybody's got a different view of it. So we refer to it as work-life blend, and if you can blend the things that you love to do with your work, well, we think that's a pretty good environment to be in. So if you love to surf and you can stop off at the beach and have a surf on your way to work, well, that's blending what you like to do, you know, with your work life. If you like building brands and creating different beers and beer styles, and if that's your work, well, you know, you've got greater blend there.
So, yeah, right, great answer. And that was so off the top of your head. I really like that. It means it's really threaded through who you are as a being. How many people you got working for you?
We have 150 full-time employees and about 40 to 50 casuals who work in the tasting rooms and some casual roles in production as well.
So how does that look for you now that we're in this COVID-19 global pandemic? How has that been for you guys in the last couple of months?
It's been pretty tough. At the end of the day, we went into this in reasonable shape from a financial position. But when you lose 70% of your volume overnight, that's going to have a big impact on the business. What we immediately did, because we knew that there was no end in sight, we know that the government said this could be something that will go on for 6 months. Mm. So the first thing that we did was obviously cut costs wherever we could. No problems about cutting costs in travel, because that wasn't on the radar anyway. But all costs in the business, and we also initiated a 20% pay cut for the entire team, mm-hmm. And a 30% pay cut for the most senior people within the business.
Mm-hmm. So you're leading from the top?
Yeah. Well, arguably, everyone's in it together. So that was one of the first things that we did. Our number one priority was to try and maintain 100% of our employees. And particularly the 150 full-time people who have been with us for the longest.
Because your retention and staff is pretty second to none. You have guys with you for a long time, guys and girls.
Yeah. We're quite fortunate. We are in a regional area, we're fortunate that we have people who have come to this area or have been here that are looking for long-term careers. And so our priority was to try and maintain, 100% employment, with that group. It's a strong team, and, without those reductions in wages, we would have had to have looked at laying people off, And the first month out of COVID, so April was an absolute disaster for us financially. But luckily, with the wage... wage cuts and JobKeeper
Allowed
has allowed us to keep everybody on.
Yeah, Yeah, because it's really hard. I mean, it's okay to say JobKeeper, but there was this period in between where businesses actually had to fund that.
Yeah, indeed. Yes.
And for those that they're the ones that we're now seeing have fallen over, unfortunately, because they couldn't actually, you know, borrow money or fund that. What was it? A 6-week period?
Yeah, it was. We were lucky that we were in a position to fund that until JobKeeper came through. Mm-hmm. So. But yeah, we're fortunate for that program, because arguably we wouldn't have the number of people that we have in our business without it.
I've heard that across the board, and I can relate that back to myself as well. One question that sort of comes up in my own head is, what do we look like? And we may not know the answer to this, but what do we look like when we don't have JobKeeper?
Hopefully the economy will be in a position where it can start to climb back out. Mm-hmm. And each industry is different. Mm-hmm. And it's not often that you go through a crisis like this where every industry is affected, from lawyers, accountants, construction. Yeah, I'm sure construction, it may come after.
Mm, but absolutely every industry.
Every industry, yeah, it's mind-boggling.
However, the one that you and I skate in probably the most, in tourism and hospitality.
Yes.
Because you guys have got an amazing tasting room down there that I've often used as a journalist for stories, you know. So that to me is a destination unto itself. So you've added that part to your business. Maybe just explain what that is for people down there.
Yeah, so our tasting room, so our head office, if you like, for Stone & Wood is in Byron Bay. We have the original 25-hectolitre brew house here on site that we still brew a lot of beers with. The main production facility is in Woolloombah, so on the Northern Rivers.
Yeah, great.
But what we built here at the Byron site was a tasting room, so people could come to the home of Stone & Wood.
Yeah.
They could have a tasting paddle of beers, buy a t-shirt, a cap or what have you, talk to the Stone & Wood people, and then go on their merry way and visit the other...
I'm going to add something to that, because I was coming for that exact reason, and then I didn't even realise, excuse my ignorance, that a 100-mile table had popped up in your business. I'm assuming they're still there.
Yeah.
So this is something you probably, because you're so close to your business, from someone outside looking in, I'm like, of course a 100-mile table is going to pop up at Stone & Wood, because that's all about sustainability, local produce, and just damn good food. So obviously you think about that, Ross?
Yeah, well, we're a Northern Rivers based business. So sustainability, environmental sustainability has been in our DNA from the outset.
Mm-hmm.
But firstly, you need business sustainability. You need a profitable business that allows you to invest in environmental sustainability, to be able to support the communities that you operate in.
Mm-hmm.
And good businesses that make good money get to do good things for the community. So
it doesn't happen the other way around, hey?
No, arguably not.
I really like what you just said then, because I have the right and left-hand brain, but I would definitely be skating more down that creative side. You know? So I'd be that one in the meeting that would give you shitloads of ideas, and you have to go, they're not going to sustain cars, you know? So I've just learned from you then that you really, it might sound really naive on my behalf, but you really do need business sustainability before you've got anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Is that what that MBA did for you, Ross?
Oh,
Should I have done an MBA?
No, I think it's just the, it's just the necessities of running a business, and we have a very transparent culture within our business.
Mm-hmm.
Nearly 80% of our employees are shareholders.
Wow.
So
that's an investment.
Yeah, it is an investment, but it also...
No, they invest into your business.
Well, they don't have to buy the shares. So we gift the shares to our team members, co-workers.
Mm-hmm.
And those shares, they are actually paid off. We don't get the proceeds. Jamie, Brad and I don't get the proceeds of the sale of those shares. The business does. And the dividends from those shares go to pay off a loan of those shares.
But if you're slacking off in the business as an individual, you're not going to get that benefit.
Well,
the business won't get the benefit.
The business won't get the benefit. Therefore, the value that as a co-worker that you're creating in the business isn't going to be as good.
Well, that's a carrot for someone. That would be a carrot for me.
Indeed. And that's why we're all in it together. It's a bit of a cliche COVID. You know, we're in it together.
I think you guys, you've always done that. Yeah.
But, We also honestly believe that the people who are developing the value in the business should get to reap the reward of that value.
That's why Stone & Wood has been such a, I don't mean successful financially, it's just been such a successful brand globally in ethics, integrity and care.
One of the things that we did when we set the business up, we wanted to be everything, not everything, but a lot of things that large corporates weren't.
Right.
So we wanted it to be a fun place to work. We didn't want masses of systems and processes, although we didn't want that to be an excuse for not being professional as
yes,
well.
Yes.
We wanted it to be nimble. And move quickly with market dynamics. We wanted to create a business that people enjoyed coming to without the politics of what large corporates were. So we wanted to create something that we wanted to come to work in every day ourselves.
That must be a constant check-in, Ross, because your business has grown exponentially over the years. So I don't know, one thing I've always wondered about organisations like Stone & Wood, how do you stop yourself when you start to make good money from turning into that corporate? Is it just a constant check-in with the team?
Well, it's a culture that you develop.
At the start?
Yeah, at the start. And at the end of the day, it's Jamie, Brad and I are only three people in this business of 150 now. So the culture is very much of the other 147 people, you know, in this business. Mm. So it's, you know, it's that strong culture that has sustained us through this COVID period. It's only strengthened the relationships that everybody has within the business.
Yeah, so it's I love it's culture. It's really all it comes down to at the end of the day. You can talk about mission statements and objectives on flowcharts and all the rest of it. But if you don't have set up a culture in the first instance, it's not going to work.
And culture is the only thing that no one can copy. In a business.
Yeah.
People can come up with the same style of beer or same flavours and same this and same that, but it's impossible to replicate a culture within an organisation.
That's such a strong statement. So you guys, you were opening Brisbane at Christmas. I just want to touch on this because the tasting room downstairs is fantastic and it's coming back as we speak. The Brisbane, was it an old wool factory or what was Brisbane?
Yeah, it was an old ice stores, actually.
Oh,
so
right, okay.
Yeah, and so it's a 100-year-old building that has beautiful street appeal. You know, it's still in its original format in Fortitude Valley. On Bridge Street in Fortitude Valley. We're quite fortunate to have found a building of that age and style. It just lends itself perfectly to be a brewery tap room.
Who found that one?
I'm not sure how it came up. Jamie had, I think he had an alert because we were looking for properties all over Brisbane.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Jamie had an alert and it popped up and he said, oh, if you're up there, go and have a look at it. So it's one of those things where you drive up to and you just go, wow, okay.
It's the fun part of business.
That's the fun part.
It's got to be the fun part.
Right, job done. We found the spot and we've got great landlords up there. Who have been who take a long term view. The funny thing about beer, you have to have a long term view of it. It takes a long time to develop brands.
Jesus, my husband would really be happy you said that.
Yeah, oh, good.
I'm gonna tell him that you said. Well, he'll listen to this, Gregory. A long term view about beer. Okay.
Yeah.
So Brisbane opened with gusto in December. I saw it. It was beautiful. And then you had to close for a little while.
So obviously the bushfires didn't do us any favours either. The floods in February didn't add to that a great deal, unfortunately.
Mm.
And then, launch into COVID. So it's been a rough start for Brisbane. But we've turned it into a makeshift bottle shop.
Great. Because the interest is there.
Yeah, the interest is there. Yeah, absolutely. People just love the opportunity of still driving by and sticking their head in and grabbing a six-pack or a carton. And yeah, we're still brewing beers on the brewery that we have up there. So
yep.
We sell those in sharers, bottles, you can take those away.
Yeah, right. So, oh, you bring them back and get them refilled?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. So that probably, looking forward, we're looking July, you know, in the next month, you'll be okay with that 50 as well, will you? Are you dipping onto restaurants or something a bit different?
Yeah, it's all different. State by state is different also. So in New South Wales, we can open up to 50 as of this coming Monday, the 1st of June. Queensland, we'll know more over the next few days on how that opens up from only having 10 at the moment. So, but, you know, as we, you know, we're operational there now, so we can just adapt as things open up. And
yeah, I really feel for my hospitality family. I've owned a restaurant before, a Spanish restaurant. I think you remember that one. And I just think back to those days when I might have had a whinge and I go, you know, there wasn't a lot to whinge about. I'm not saying it's a disaster, but it's an endurance race for you guys right now. And hanging out with my mates in hospitality, they're pretty tired just from keeping up with the regulations that are coming out constantly, you know, and working out how to reinvent. But I tell you what, they've been so innovative and creative. Yes. I'm super proud of our industry, tourism as well, because I just think that it's given us a chance to push pause and just realign our business and then see what we can do to innovate it, whether it's delivery to home, you know, whether it's, do we need 400 people on a Friday night? Do we need 100? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, so, but you've had a real test in sustainability and your whole business is about sustainability.
Yeah, it probably goes back to what I was saying a little bit earlier, you know, when they closed the industry on the 23rd of March, we just had to adapt and, like a lot of businesses have, you know, we're not the only ones out there. The equipment that we have and the infrastructure that we have doesn't allow us to mothball it. You know, we have to keep it running. It's a lot of machinery. Mm-hmm. So we just got to limp along until, yeah, we start to climb out. I heard this phrase the other day, it's an elevator down and a staircase back up.
Not
too long, I hope.
Do you know what? I will say this. I'm really proud of Stonewood as an Australian brand. I just think, firstly, we need more really good examples of Australian brands. And you've just, you're pretty much all over the world. Would that be right? You're exporting in all different sorts of places.
Yeah. We, particularly Singapore and Hong Kong, they're great export markets for us. We have beer in the United Kingdom. Easy to do business there. They think and talk like us. So we actually brew our draft beer in the UK now, so we're not sending kegs halfway around the planet.
Sustainability?
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't make sense from a packaged beer exercise at the moment, but it will. So yeah, for the immediate term anyway, it's great to be brewing draft beer in the UK, although we're not brewing anything at the moment.
I feel like maybe in 20 years time we'll have another one of these chats, maybe earlier than that, and we'll talk about, you know, like brands like you guys, Brookies, Husk, seem to be an alcohol here, but you know, there's plenty of amazing Spell, you name it, and they're just good Australian brands. Like in our day when we would go overseas and be proud to have a Vegemite.
Yes,
you got to be, because we have sold out a lot of brands in this country and we need to bring them back into localization. You're doing a really good job of that.
Yeah, I think Australians are very innovative, you know, as a group of people, we're always looking for solutions to all sorts of problems, I think, and you know, that's a result of where we are. We're this island country, so we have to...
Time to live it.
Yeah. I think through COVID-19, we're looking at how we can support our own communities and our own countrymen better than what we have done in the past. So hopefully there'll be more production industries popping up as a result of this. We'll be more self-reliant. And then we can dictate how the environmental sustainability of those production businesses operate. Arguably, it's hard to do when they're halfway around the planet. I honestly believe that Australians have an environmental bent and are going to identify ways to produce things more environmentally aware than arguably what other countries would.
I agree with you, absolutely. And dictate's a good word.
Yeah.
Yeah. So who and where? This is about people to place this podcast. So a person to a place. We've painted you into a picture of where you've grown up, and I can see your heritage and how it comes back through now. There's always a thread. Who and where in the world inspires you? It's a top of the head question, Ross.
Yeah. I think it can be at any time. Someone, you know, inspires you. Bill Gates, it'd have to be someone that's pretty inspirational, and I know it's topical at the moment.
No, can I just go there for a moment? Thank you for saying Bill Gates, because on my business card, my business has been going for 20 years, I've got on the bottom of it, what I do best is share my enthusiasm. It's a Bill Gates quote. I like to think that's what I do in my life. And the other day, I looked at my letterhead only yesterday, and because of what you just said, you know, there's a bit of controversy around him, which I don't actually attach to. I was wondering what the reaction, my sensitive side was going, what's the reaction to this quote that I'm, you know, the quote on my quote? I went, no, I endorse Bill Gates.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's a phenomenal human being, and what he has done for world health is, you know, mind-boggling. He's done more than what countries have done and continues to do.
Yeah.
He's a visionary. He has very little ego.
I agree.
It's an interesting documentary that I watched just recently called Inside Bill's Brain. And it was a three-part series. And what he is trying to do for the climate. So not only health is something that he is very actively involved with, but also environmentally, he's at the forefront of trying to reduce global CO2 emissions, and it's amazing.
So let's pay homage to him. I'm with you. That is a great answer. And where in the world inspires you?
It's hard to go past our own backyard. You know, this is such, and I've been fortunate enough to travel in a lot of different places. Culturally, I think the Nordic countries are doing a pretty good job. They have great communities up there. They're very environmentally aware. They look after each other. It's stunning countryside. It's just absolutely gorgeous.
It's on my list when it opens back up.
Beautiful. Yeah, beautiful places.
Wow, they're good answers. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. I really admire your work ethic, and your brand is really cool. Love it.
Good to chat, Kyles.
Thanks, Ross.